Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today, we are talking about what is a commodity, and we are joined by the CEO of Pan Exchange, Julie Lerner. Julie, thank you for being here with us this evening.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's really an honor. I've been looking forward to this.
Likewise, and we really, for this episode, we wanted to kind of go back to the basics. We want to dive in, and of course, given your background, working for Cargill, now working with Pan Exchange, this commodity trading platform, it seems very necessary to define what the term commodity means, and then, of course, how that term relates and connects into the cannabis industry. So, Julie, if you would, let me tell us a little bit about your background, and then let's dive into just defining the word commodity.
Sure. I'd love to. I so rarely get to really talk about this market that's so near and dear to my heart. I started my career with Cargill in Geneva, Switzerland, and later moved on to become their senior trader for Latin American sugar. Couple hops and skips in my career. I was with Sempra Energy Trading when electricity was deregulated, and I've also worked on weather derivatives or weather indices with Exxon Financial. So I really have a cross commodity and cross geography background that I'm bringing to the hemp space, if you will. So what is a commodity in my mind? Interesting. So when you're speaking with natural resources, here's the funny thing. The word commodity is a misnomer. And what I mean by that is when you're negotiating a commodity, and it doesn't matter whether it's energy, metals, or agriculture, you have up to 12 different variables that you need to negotiate and before you can conclude a purchase and sale contract, and all of them affect price. You need to talk about the specific quality, the quantity, the delivery window. Are you going to come get it at the farm gate, or do you want me to deliver it to you? How are we going to price this, and how are you going to pay for it? And so we believe that hemp is very much a commodity. It's in its infancy. But the interesting thing is, I know, Bob, that a lot of your listeners come from the marijuana space. As a Colorado company, we looked at this a few years ago, and I came away then and still am convinced today, marijuana is not a commodity, and I don't think it will become one.
That's a great point, and that is something we talked about previously, and I couldn't agree with you more, because if you think about the marijuana industry, it is so niche in the sense that it's dependent on, certainly in the United States, it's in the face of federal law, but it's dependent on sort of local sourcing of natural products. It doesn't necessarily go to bulk pricing and international transport. And I do have a theory that industrial hemp in the aggregate fills all of the needs globally for what the cannabis plant can do. In effect, you don't need marijuana when the cannabis plant is commoditized as industrial hemp because there's enough THC in an acre of industrial hemp, even at 0.3%, to supply, refine, and otherwise a pharmaceutical company or a research and development company or an ingredient manufacturer. So some of those things seem to hold true as you juxtapose marijuana versus hemp. But one thing that's interesting about being a commodity is everyone says, wait till it becomes commoditized and wait till things are a commodity, as if that's a negative thing. I don't see it as a negative thing. I would presume you don't as well, having worked in the field and understanding the concept for as long as you have, because at the end of the day, commoditization gives farmers certainty. It gives the market certainty. It gives insurers certainty. It's just, it creates a static, certain component that, yes, fluctuates, but within boundaries. Can you comment on some of that?
I'd love to. Yeah, and I agree with you. you know, a lot of people say that the big trade houses are the evil guys, and they always, you know, they're cheap with the farmers and this and that. The reality is that's a sign of market maturation where they play a really important role. They take counterparty risk, which is huge in this space, as you know. They take transportation risk. They can store it. I'm looking forward to the day when we have that. Commoditization also means that we've got some sense of stability, which is different from liquidity, from volatility. So we've got this stability and liquidity, and we'll get there for sure. And we're on our way. It's a rapidly evolving market. But so I had the good fortune of being invited to the University of Colorado Symposium on Commodities. They have a J.P. Morgan Commodity Center, and I submitted a paper on the seven stages of market maturation. If anybody wants to geek out on commodities like me, it's actually posted on our blog. But in a super condensed version of what you're talking about, you know, we could take, if you look at it as a timeline, on the far right, you've got wheat, corn, and soy, your cash crops. And these are fully mature markets. They're as commoditized as they can get with regard to futures contracts for hedging. There's nearly perfect competition, and that forces trade houses to focus on deal flow and operating efficiency to improve profitability. So let's go to the far left. Let's go to the beginning. And I think that we could look at hemp, fiber, and herd as the first stage of market maturation. And please cut me off if I'm getting too nerdy on this. So fiber and herd is at the embryonic stage of a market. So at this point, the market is all about surety of supply. So we have farmers coming to us for hemp and fiber and for fiber and herd, saying, you know, hey, you know, when are you going to build a market for this? Let's, you know, connect me with buyers. And as much as it pains me, I have to say to them, no, you need to go directly and to the buyers and build your relationships. You need to grow for spec. And what I mean by that is it's super important to get it right with regard to, say, if you're talking plastics and hempcrete, the durability of it. It's important to know that the raw material is not too sticky that's going to jam the processing equipment, or too dusty that's a fire hazard. So you need to work with these entities, build long-term relationships, and then you have to prove it again the next year. We're not even there yet. Prove that you can grow the same product consistently in the next year. And so I think the CBD, hemp for CBD, is in the next phase. And so what happens there is, and the Farm Bill definitely pushed it forward in this market, is that suddenly you have a plethora of suppliers. And usually when this happens in a market, the new guys are either geographically advantageous to the incumbents or have a better technology, which means that they can offer a lower price. So all this is happening at once, where suddenly surety of supply is not as important. It's all there. You're going to get your biomass when you need it. And that's where Pan Exchange comes in. So we're able to bring transparency with our benchmark pricing. There's real dialogue around price now. Price is the biggest thing that matters. So we have this bilateral market. We're building the cash market. We definitely have a ways to go in building liquidity, which I hope comes more this year. I think what's next for CBD is the more efficient cash market, which is also called the spot market, what we do. So as you guys know, some M&A is happening. The buyers and sellers will become known to one another. There'll be trust in the marketplace. Reputations will be built. And it allows us to negotiate the product by specifications, not by COAs and samples. And all this is happening. Pan Exchange is building a historical database of benchmark prices. So very soon, we hope that we'll be working with the futures exchange to offer a futures contract to fully hedge price risk.
Well, the price risk element is extremely interesting, and I'd like to talk about how you build those into contracts, et cetera. But let's drill into some of the indexing that you talked about, because at the end of the day, there's a lot of challenges with building a pricing index in an industry that, let's face it, a fact's a fact, in the United States at least, the FDA does not regulate these CBD products. So to evaluate a static marketplace is a bit of a misnomer, and pricing is known to go high and low and deteriorate over time and reflect very sensitively to even the slightest indication of a market downturn or a market upturn. So how do you gather appropriate data? How do you ensure that the data is reflective, and how do you ensure that you have the right processes in place to update that data, not because of a knee-jerk reaction like so many of the data sources tend to do, but in a way that reflects more of a gradual change in the market versus those herky-jerky changes that tend to stabilize over time?
Sure. I really appreciate that question. So we follow IOSCO guidelines. It's not the same entity that regulates the seed market here in the U.S. This is the only entity worldwide, it's European-based, that issues guidelines and approves benchmark pricing. And we absolutely follow those guidelines. So we don't launch a new mark until we're confident that we have a consistent and balanced pool of price submitters. So it's important to note that in our prices, we only allow growers, processors, trade houses, and end users that meet our vetting process for the trading platform. There are no brokers, no analysts, no industry association reps. The people who are involved in the price submission program must have skin in the game and pass our vetting process.
Well, I want to pick up this point because it's so near and dear to my heart, which is the forward contracting element for farmers. And as you said, and it is just so true, this is an immature market. We are definitely on the far left side of the stages of maturation on the path to becoming a true commodity. I'd be interested if you could talk a little bit about what we saw last year in 2019 with hemp farming. As you mentioned, the abundance of biomass, the CBD biomass that just kind of is sitting around at this point, what you're expecting for 2020, because not only is forward contracting important for all the things we've talked about, but it is also important for crop insurance, for financing purposes. If you can't assign a dollar amount to the crop that you're growing and something goes wrong, what do you do?
Absolutely. I mean, look, the elephant in the room, let's discuss it. There is a lack of commercial buyers in the hemp space. And that's something that we need to see more of going forward. Part of it is due in part because of vertically integrated players out of the gate who ended up with a surplus themselves. And the cold hard fact is that from January to July, biomass prices fell 84%. So the interesting thing here, and something that I'm looking forward to discussing with you guys much more, is how to contract against a benchmark price to eliminate your price risk. Now, this is something that's actually done in all mature markets. So when you're negotiating fixed price contracts, even if it's for 3 weeks in advance, as opposed to 3 months in advance, that's a sign of an immature market when you have tools at the ready to avoid this price risk. So, I mean, in a nutshell, if you're negotiating biomass, you would trade against the pan exchange benchmark that expires the month of the delivery of the physical product. And as I said, I'm looking forward to doing a deep dive. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
Well, absolutely. Certainly. And I believe that is going to be the hour-long webinar on June 25th at noon Mountain Time that you, yourself, and Bob will be a part of, which we will share through our materials so that we can get that out there. Because these are very, very important topics and issues that really anybody who's growing hemp this year, anybody who's a part of that supply chain needs to be thinking about. I would, if you wouldn't mind, just for a moment, talking about, you know, what does it mean to trade on spec? What is the difference between futures and forwards? Just give us a sense of, for any farmers who are listening, for anybody who's simply in this position right now, maybe they're growing a crop, they bought the seeds, they're growing a crop, but they don't even have an end buyer that they've identified, because as you mentioned, there really aren't that many out there. What would you advise them to do today to just try to get some security for themselves?
Sure. So let me unpack a little bit of that. The trading on spec means trading as per specifications. There's an adage in mature markets that you're only as good as your last trade. And that's because even though these markets are global, the big players are all known to each other. And if you default once, it may be your last trade. Your word is your bond. Relationships matter. So bringing that back to trading on spec, what it means is that a seller comes online and will say, I have 10,000 pounds of milled biomass with 10% CBD. This is the price I'm looking at. And then you negotiate negotiate all the terms and the price and so forth, and you lock in the deal. It's not until the title transfer, when the goods move from seller to buyer, that you test the product. So, you know, it was a little bit soul crushing for me as the person who designed this platform when our director of hemp came to me and said, we have to disable automatic matching on the platform because no buyer is going to accept an offer until they see the COA and oftentimes the a lab result. There's no way we're going to build a liquid market until we can move past that stage. So that's the trading on spec. Futures versus forwards, I do have another blog post that talks about the lingo here, and it does get confusing. In commodities, a futures contract is a derivative of the underlying cash market. That's the market we're in, right? The actual deal flow from farm to processor. And a forward contract is the negotiation of that physical price. So we don't have a futures market yet. And I certainly hope we get there soon.
Well, I hope we get there soon as well. When you talk about futures, you talk about trading things on paper that don't yet exist. When you think about supply contracts, you think about contingencies on pricing and price variations. And sort of just to go back and tie a nice little bow on the pricing index component, you and I have talked about this before, mm-hmm. that there are strategies by which those pricing indexes can be particularly useful for those folks engaged in the wholesale trade concerning CBD and other non-psychoactive cannabinoids, but it also applies to every other component of the plant. But it's exacerbated in the CBD element of the world because, as we've talked about, what your platform does is it sort of professionalizes or enables the professionalization of the transactions in this space. There's a term called joker brokers, and that's increasingly gotten better, but the joker brokers have sort of proliferated the CBD ingredient side of the industry for many years now. And I mentioned it has improved, but this improves it dramatically. So if I've got a contract and I know that the pricing is likely to change and you can identify certain reasons that it would change, how would you go to an objective third-party source and identify how that pricing should change? So let me give you an example. If the president were to come out and say, I'm going to carve a pathway to make CBD very easy in the short term to produce, that would have an impact on pricing. And then the counter would be if a politician came out and said, we're going to put the CBD industry to an end, that, of course, would have a dramatic impact on pricing, and it's something in between. The political impact. There's the market impact. There's the saturation components. There's just the basics of supply and demand. But at the end of the day, pricing does fluctuate. We saw a kilo of isolate and or distillate go for tens of thousands of dollars just 5 or 6 years ago. And you can find those in the hundreds of dollars in bulk right now in the state of Colorado and some other places. Now, there's a number of factors there. And yes, that's over time. But fluctuations do happen in real time. And they happen very, very quickly. So what are some strategies to utilize benchmark pricing or to negotiate provisions within a contract that would in fact contemplate that. So there was a fair and even way to modify those prices and those terms given an event like that happens in the marketplace?
That's an excellent question. And the short answer is those events are embedded into the benchmark prices. So because the market dictates to us where it is and where it thinks it is. As we come up to the end of the month when we issue our prices, so we've got what's negotiated on the platform plus the reported values and verifying one against the other, and they always jive. They're priced into the market. So, I mean, I think maybe one of the things, a way to look at it, if you're a producer and you're worried about the inventory that's sitting there now from 2019 as we head into the new crop year, you may want to lock in prices today. And that's a pretty good strategy. But the reality is, let's look at last year. You know, if you locked in prices in January, how many of you were defaulted on? How many buyers are really going to show up and honor that contract that they priced that was so much above the market? When you price against a benchmark, you're saying, okay, I agree to sell to you for delivery 3 months from today. And we're going to negotiate, let's say I have a superior crop and I am geographically desirable, if you will. So we're going to negotiate an actual dollar per pound over whatever the mark is that Pan Exchange publishes in October. And that's the essence of basis trading. Again, I look forward to getting into it further. So all of those world events that you're talking about are priced into that. And sometimes they'll work for you and sometimes they'll work against you, but this is the most steady way to always know you're never gonna be too far from the market and good realistic prices in the market where both parties know that they're getting a real deal.
You know, I want to pick up one point, Julie, which is you talked about how right now there's so much focus on COAs and all of this work to try to prove what you grew. Maybe you could speak for a second. In my mind, it all starts with what genetics you're using, what you're putting in the ground from the beginning. If we have a real standardized genetic that we're using, doesn't that alleviate on the back end some of the work of having to prove what you're doing? And then when you really look at the fiber, herd, grain parts of the plant, not the CBD parts of the plant, where it maybe makes more sense to have a more diverse range of available genetics so you can get different cannabinoid formulations, et cetera. I guess my question is, don't you want a standardized input, one or two or three standardized varieties? Isn't that kind of the way that they're doing things in Europe, in other parts of the world? I look to the Canadian grain markets. There's a certain amount of Canadian grain varieties. They've been growing them for decades and decades and decades. And now it's kind of at the point where it's like, well, why do we really want any other varieties? We have something that works. We have at what level of maturation or stage of maturation you would consider the Canadian grain market for hemp, but probably more mature than the U.S. I guess, what are your thoughts on the seed genetics, just that starting point for farmers, how that plays into the whole commodity exchange, benchmarking, price risk components?
Yeah, absolutely. A standardized seed produces a standardized crop, in short, right? But we want to give some freedom of movement, right? So obviously you're going to have different seeds for different cannabinoids, and you're going to have different seeds for fiber and herd than you would for the CBD-CBG market. There should be some variety too, of course, to account for geography. You know, you're going to want a different seed in Minnesota than you will in Florida, for example, based on sunshine and climate and temperatures. So I'm all for that, and that is also another aspect that needs to happen.
Well, no, seed and genetic standardization is really the foundation for what happens here in the United States. And unfortunately, there's a lot of back and forth, and I don't think we have a clear path out of the woods yet as it relates to how that becomes regulated, how that becomes stabilized, because you look at folks that want to push high CBD genetics and genetics that are other than certified seeds, and that allows for uncertainty in the cultivation process, which creates additional uncertainty in terms of the yield, in terms of investment, in terms of futures and purchasing crops before they come out of the ground. And those are all challenges that directly impact the viability of this being commoditized, so to speak. But, you know, this is it's a fascinating topic, and you've said it all, but I do think that one of the two takeaways, there's so many takeaways, but one really big one is marijuana is probably not commoditized, but industrial hemp certainly is, will continue to be, or will sort of become more prominently displayed in that light as the infrastructure develops to take a plant and bring it into multiple sectors in the marketplace.
Julie, I have one more question for you, if you will, which is you come from this background, working for Cargill, working in these other amazing industries. You have all this knowledge about commoditization. I want to know, what excites you once hemp does go through some more of these stages and we get a more mature market? Is it perhaps the carbon credits, or just what are those things that will become available once this does really become commoditized? Because you've seen it happen before. You've seen what becomes available for another industry or for another commodity when you finally get there. I'm just interested in what excites you the most once we get to stage 7, perhaps.
Oh, wow. Wow, I've never been asked that question.
That's a digger. I'm digging.
Yeah, we're going to dig deep for that. I think there's two pieces to it. I mean, one, I'm just excited about working in a brand new industry on home turf in our country, because I often work internationally. And I'm just bullish on this crop. I mean, it is a weed, let's call it what it is, but it is the most useful weed we have. To your point, carbon credits, it's carbon friendly. It takes up less area than cotton farming for textiles, and it's environmentally friendly for hempcrete and plastics and so forth. So that's one area that I'm excited about. The second one is just being able to be an active participant in growing this market. We don't often get new markets, new commodities. This is unbelievably exciting, and if we can help get this market up that maturation scale, everybody wins. Everybody, you know, it's more efficient, it's more profitable. If we can help build some hedging instruments, that excites me.
That's such a good point. That how often in one's lifetime does a new commodity really, and it doesn't happen that often. It is something to be very excited about, to get to be a part of and watch and watch it all grow. And this was really just part one of a bigger conversation that's coming on June 25th, the hour-long Pan Exchange webinar. That's noon Mountain Time. It looks like registration for that will be opening pretty soon. Look out for all of the HLG newsletter. We will be promoting that, be pushing that out to our folks. Julie, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. You're a wealth of knowledge. You're doing such excellent work to make this commoditization occur, hopefully faster than sooner rather than later, I guess. But you know, until next time, it's been a real joy.
Well, thank you both so much. This has been a real pleasure.
All righty, take care, Julie.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.